Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington, D.C.
They commit to the target. They commit to short-term targets to track change. And they commit to measuring food waste in their own operations.
A UN report says we waste nearly 20% of the food produced worldwide, while more than 780 people go hungry.
In its ruling, the court had ruled that it needs to take a look at the documents and make up its own mind whether the defense argument or assertion was correct.
A Malawi court this week rules on whether the National Defense Force can withhold national security documents in a case against a high-ranking official.
The Constitution we have right now provide for the means to change or amend Constitution, and this way is not followed.
And Togo activists urge the president not to sign a controversial measure. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. A new UN report says the world wasted about 19% of the food produced globally in 2022, more than a billion metric tons. The number of countries reporting for the index nearly doubled from the first report in 2021. Researchers analyzed country data on households, food service, and retailers. They found that each person wastes about 174 pounds of food each year. Co-author Clementine O'Connor calls it a travesty at a time when 783 million people around the world face chronic hunger, including many in Africa. She tells me that the problem is complicated, but it's one that can be tackled through collaboration.
This is a topic that I've worked on for 15 years, so certainly aware of how hard it is to take action on this topic and the need for a systemic approach to tackle this, because there is not just one solution that will fix this problem.
It's complicated. Everybody gets that, but it can be tackled. So how can it be tackled?
Yes. So there are a handful of countries that have been working on this for quite a long time at this point. We highlight in the report the UK and Japan that have been measuring food waste since 2007 and 2008, respectively. And the fact that they have this data has helped them to create a case for action, to change policy, to rally the private sector around this, to work together on a collaborative approach.
What do they do? They work with restaurants, or I don't know how you do this on a big scale.
So what we showcase in the report is the public-private partnership model. Which brings together the government, as many as possible of the bigger retailers, the food manufacturers with their suppliers. They commit to the target. They commit to short-term targets to track change. And they commit to measuring food waste in their own operations, in their supply chains, and to reporting that data.
But that's just reporting it, you know, and that's getting more clear data on it. I mean, like, how do you actually, like in the United States, a lot of people waste food. They just do because they can. They've got that kind of income. And if they don't finish their meal, they don't take it home. They throw it away. How do you get that kind of food, or the food that's not even used for a night that, you know, all this food prep goes on in restaurants, and get it over to places where they need it? I mean, does it work that way even, or how does it play out so that you can try to help feed the people that are hungry? Some people even dying of starvation. How do they get the food?
So to quickly complete on the public-private partnership, it's a target measure act approach. So once you've done that measurement, it helps you to identify the hotspots and to build a working group around that targets the specific causes of that food waste that have been identified there. So these partnerships always have a working group that is focused on improving redistribution and food donation process to make sure that all of the big retailers and as many of the food service operators as possible have a partnership in place with a local food bank, and that they streamline the logistics of that, because it doesn't happen on its own. It needs a process to make it happen smoothly, particularly in the food service sector. We're looking at foods that have a very short lifespan, and they need to get to those in need as quickly as possible.
So you're saying, like, part of the loop in all that, besides identifying, you know, where this food waste is happening, is setting up distribution too.
Indeed, I think that's a part of it. It's also helping citizens to buy the right amount of food, to forecast how much they're going to need. When they buy more than they need, to check that they put that in the freezer or they store that appropriately to make that last longer.
That is Clementine O'Connor. She is co-author of a new United Nations report on food waste.
While harmful cultural practices such as female genital mutilation or forced marriage are well known, most people may not be aware of breast ironing, a practice where young girls have their breasts flattened to deter unwanted male attention. On this week's edition of Our Voices, we will discuss why certain communities carry out such a painful practice. Join the conversation on Wednesdays at 1900 UTC on The Voice of America.
The semi-autonomous Somali state of Puntland announced Sunday it would no longer recognize federal institutions after parliament supported a plan for a one-person, one-vote election system. It's the latest move in a long-running saga, with Puntland issuing similar declarations over and over in recent years to express its disagreement with the central government in Mogadishu. Arid Puntland, in Somalia's northeast, claimed autonomy in 1998, bolstered by natural resources, including oil, and its Bosaso port. A statement released by the region said Puntland will have its own comprehensive government authority until a federal government system is in place with a mutually accepted Somali constitution that is subject to a public referendum. Area authorities oppose the adoption of by parliament of the plan to reintroduce universal suffrage and end the complex clan-based indirect voting system that has been in place for more than a half century in the Horn of African nation. On Saturday, lawmakers approved 4 of 15 constitutional chapters, which are due to be amended later as part of the overhaul.
We had requested to have some documents discovered or rather produced for the defense so that they can exercise their...
In Malawi, a high court decides on Tuesday whether the Malawi Defense Force can withhold sensitive national security documents from the defense team of Vice President Saulus Chilima. The lead defense lawyer says to do so undermines the legal right of Chilima to a fair trial. Kale Kafale, a former attorney general, says he expects the court to rule fairly. Lawyers for the vice president demanded written communications between President Lazarus Chakwera and a commander of the Malawi Defense Force. The security agency has refused to provide the documents, citing national security concerns. For more, VOA's Peter Clotie reached Kale Kafale, Chilima's lead defense attorney.
We had requested to have some documents discovered or rather produced for the defense so that they can exercise their right to properly defend themselves. And the prosecution had indicated that the documents could be containing security-sensitive information. And in its ruling, the court had ruled that it needs to take a look at the documents and make up its own mind whether the defense argument or assertion was correct. And could the defense therefore take those documents to the court so that the court could examine them and make whatever consequential orders that it could make under the circumstances. And we understand that the prosecution managed to take the documents to the court, and here we're talking about the Malawi Defence Force through the Attorney General's office, did that, and on Tuesday the court will deliver its ruling on what its views are relating to the argument or the assertion by the prosecution that the documents could have contained security or sensitive information.
Mr. Kapale, you were a former Attorney General. You know how sensitive the document that you are requesting on behalf of your client is. What are your expectations of the anticipated ruling on Tuesday?
Well, your question has planted within it some assumptions that are not correct, but I will just say that we expect a fair judgment, a fair ruling, considering that the accused person has a fundamental right, constitutional right to a fair trial, and that he wants to advance this right in the circumstances that he finds himself in. At the end of the day, we believe that the prosecution will have to make a choice if it wants to keep away some documents because they are security sensitive, but yet the documents are relevant to the accused person's defense, then they would rather withdraw the prosecution and let the accused free. They cannot have it both ways. Preserve the integrity of the state security as well as subject a citizen to an unfair trial. A balance has to be struck somewhere, and the accused's interests, I think, should run paramount, and that's how we're looking at it.
So, Kapale, are you saying if the prosecutors do not present this document, or it will be injurious to the case of your client?
Precisely, because we have a line of defense that we are pursuing, and if those documents are not availed to the defendant, that line of defense, it's not going to be possible to pursue that line, which is a legitimate line of defense. It's only that being in the media, I cannot disclose what that line of defense is. But those documents are key to the defense line of argument, to the defense theory of the case.
Well, what do you say to analysts who have been saying that the vice president, who is your client in this case, is being treated more equally than others, that if it were to be somebody different who might not occupy the position of the vice president, such will not even occur at all? What is your response to that?
Actually, I've represented all manner of clients, be they vice presidents, be they common men on the street, and I think the accused person here is being treated equally, in an equal manner to all the accused persons that I've represented before the courts. The courts nowadays safeguard individual rights, put primacy on individual rights. They were not put in the Constitution just for decoration. They are put there to benefit accused persons so that whatever their rank, they should be able to have access to those rights and exercise them and enjoy the right to a fair trial. The state cannot trample on accused person's fair trial rights simply because it wants an accused person to stand trial. So at a certain level, when these two rights conflict, the right of a state to prosecute somebody and the right of an accused person to a fair trial, one would imagine that the weaker party, the rights of the weaker party should prevail under the circumstances.
In your case, what happens next after the court makes its ruling on Tuesday?
That is a question that I can only answer after Tuesday.
That is Kale Kafele, Solis Chilima's lead defense attorney. He was speaking with my colleague Peter Clote from Malawi. In Togo, civil society and religious groups are calling on President Faure Gnassingbé not to sign a new parliamentary measure into law. The controversial legislation amends the constitution to allow parliament to choose the next president. For more on the proposed law, VOA's Peter Clote spoke with human rights lawyer and former Togo minister Yan Yovi Degli.
The reaction of people here is that they think what is happening is an unlawful amendment of the Constitution. First, because the Constitution we have right now provide for the means to change or amend Constitution, and this way is not followed. Second, it is the way of referendum that can change completely the Constitution and the regime. This path also is not followed by our parliamentarian. And the parliamentarian are normally at the end of their term since December 2023. They cannot decide to amend the Constitution because they don't have normally this power anymore. Unfortunately, this is what happened, and people are not happy at all.
Some religious groups and some civil society groups are calling on the president not to sign this amendment passed in parliament. Do you foresee this happening? Is the president going to listen to them from where you stand?
I cannot tell you what the president is going to do, but according to the comments I'm hearing here, I don't think that there will be a positive issue regarding the position of the church leaders. I think they are playing their role, but I don't think that there will be a positive reply or positive answer to their request. Unfortunately, this is what it is.
The opposition, I understand, fears that this could become another avenue for President Paul Nyasengbe to extend his grip on power, for him to stay in power for a long time to come. Do you think their fears are legitimate?
Yes, this fear is legitimate because, you know, parliamentarian regime, you don't have a limitation of terms. You don't have. You can run as long as you can have a majority in parliament. You can run. This system is in Israel, England, which is the country of birth of this regime. We have it in Germany. You don't have, like in a presidential regime, a limitation to 2 terms. So it is clear that as long as a party can have majority in a parliament, its leader can run for the position of chief of government, of chief of executive, for all the time.
Some people are saying the situation is tensed at the moment. What do you think can be done to bring down the temperature politically?
Currently, something is happening that could have happened before the change of the Constitution. Is a discussion that one of the members of the regime has called. Myself, I was supposed to be there. Unfortunately, I have my child who went to hospital this morning, so I could not be there to discuss. This discussion could have been held before the amendment of the Constitution so that the regime or people can explain to the population that this is the reason why we want to change the Constitution. This is what the new Constitution is about. But unfortunately, once again, the right path was not followed. I think that maybe this decision can cool down the situation a little bit. But at the end of the day, as far as the amendment was adopted already, and that this text will be promulgated by the president, definitely there will be tension between the politician and the population and our leaders.
That is human rights lawyer and former Togo minister Yan Yaove Degli. He was speaking with my colleague Peter Clody. In his Easter address, Pope Francis called for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza and the release of all Israeli hostages. Today marks the most important day on the Christian calendar by deploring the suffering caused by wars. The pontiff presided over Mass in a packed St. Peter's Square and then delivered his Urbi et Orbi, meaning to the city and the world blessing and message, from the central balcony of St. Peter's Basilica, according to Reuters. The 87-year-old pontiff has been in poor health in recent weeks, forcing him on repeated occasions to restrict his public speaking and cancel engagements, as he did on Good Friday, skipping on short notice a procession at Rome's Colosseum. He did, however, take part in other Holy Week events leading up to Easter and appeared in relatively good spirits on Sunday. Easter celebrates the day in which the faithful believe Jesus rose from the dead. After the service, Francis rode around in his open-topped Popemobile to greet crowds in the square and the avenue along St. Peter's Square. The Vatican said about 60,000 people had turned up. Iraq's largest Christian denomination, the Chaldean Catholics, are canceling Easter celebrations this year to protest a presidential decision revoking the title of patriarch from Chaldean Catholic Cardinal Louis Sacco. The Chaldean Catholic Church is an ancient Eastern Rite church in full communion with the Holy See. The move highlights political tensions between groups linked to Iran-backed militias and those who oppose them, fearing their growing dominance in government and daily life. Dale Gavlak reports from Amman, Jordan.
Easter Sunday in Iraq will only be observed this year through prayers, the Chaldean Catholic Patriarchate in Baghdad announced Monday, saying all festivities, mass celebrations and processions, media coverage and reception of government officials are canceled in a sign of solidarity with Chaldean Catholic Cardinal Louis Sacco. Easter is considered the most important festival of the Christian calendar, celebrating Jesus' death and resurrection. Iraq's Chaldean Catholics say they are protesting the removal of the title Patriarch from Sacco by Iraqi President Abdellatif Rashid last July. In protest, the cardinal moved from Baghdad to Erbil, the capital of the northern autonomous region of Kurdistan, that same month, and was welcomed by the Kurdish leadership. Critics say a rogue Christian lawmaker and militia leader closely linked to Iran, Rayhan al-Kildani, influenced the president's decision. The U.S. Treasury Department sanctioned al-Kildani in 2019 for alleged human rights abuses, while others accuse him of seeking control of the Chaldean church assets, including properties that Cardinal Sacco oversees. Nadine Mayanza is the president of the Washington-based International Religious Freedom Secretariat. It encourages the improvement of religious freedom conditions in 40 countries worldwide, including Iraq. She told VOA cancellation of Easter festivities in Iraq points to the growing pressure Christians and other minorities face as Iran's influence grows in the country.
The situation for Christians is dire. The Iranian militias used to be a threat as a non-state actor, but now their influence on the Iraqi government itself is also troubling. So we see an environment hostile for the Christians of Iraq, which is why Cardinal Sacco left Baghdad and moved into the Kurdistan region. It's troubling to see what this means for one of the oldest Christian communities in the world.
Sacco was instrumental in not only making the landmark visit to Iraq of Pope Francis possible during the 2021 coronavirus pandemic, but also a great success. He told VOA that the Pope's visit made a major impression on ordinary Iraqis, but a different government is now in place, influenced by Iran. Sacco has worked for years for all of Iraq's religious and ethnic minorities to have equal citizenship rights. He hopes a visit to Washington next month by Iraqi Prime Minister Mohammed Shia al-Sudani might yield benefits.
The situation is very critical, and Christians have no trust in the future because there is no vision and no plan for real change of a real state of law, democracy, respect, in which everyone can live in dignity and freedom. Christians are still leading the country because there are no actions, only promises. The Prime Minister is visiting the United States. I hope they can ask him to do something for the benefit of Christians and to keep Christians in their land and hoping and living and dignity and freedom. Iraqi population is different. They are so nice with us. The Pope during his visit changed their mind, and they are showing us their solidarity, but not the political class.
Meanza warns that if a high-profile Christian leader such as Sacco found the threats in Baghdad difficult, forcing him to relocate to Kurdistan, imagine the vulnerabilities other Christians feel with the growing threats from Iran-backed militias. Commenting on the current political situation, Greg Kursik of Penn State University in the United States wrote, "Iraq's larger political forces do not make decisions to benefit minority communities. They make decisions based on their rivalries with one another that often have a detrimental effect on Christians and other minorities." His remarks are found in the online academic The Duck of Minerva publication. Before the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq, there were some 1.5 million Christians in Iraq, but sectarian violence over the years has dwindled their numbers to some 150,000, according to the 2022 report on international religious freedom by the U.S. State Department. Del Gavlak, VOA News, Amman.
Niger's military recently declared that the presence of American troops in the West African nation is illegal. For weeks now, U.S. officials have been meeting behind closed doors with some of Niger's military rulers to try to work out some sort of compromise to keep U.S. troops on the ground. Niger had been a key U.S. ally in the region before the coup in July of last year. The coup, one of eight in West and Central Africa since 2020, was condemned by regional and Western bodies. It also led to sanctions from the Economic Community of Western African States, or ECOWAS. Sahel expert Michael Shurkin, director of global programs at 14 North Strategies, a business intelligence firm that focuses on Africa, tells me that it's been easier for the junta to blame the U.S. for its economic problems and attacks by insurrectionists rather than to deal with those issues head on.
This is this political calculus. You know, it sells to say the West is patronizing, so we're going to be defiant towards them. Right. This makes the junta look good in the eyes of a certain portion of the Nigerian population.
Right, because they already have a good majority, or maybe not a majority, but they have a significant number of Nigerians who don't like the French, and now they're increasingly upset with Americans. So this plays into that game plan.
Right. It plays into this. Now, I mean, what's new here is the anti-American thing, which generally has not been a factor. That caught me by surprise. But one possible explanation is maybe there is a rise of anti-American discourse going on, for instance, on social media. And if that's the case, we can certainly blame the Russians for that. But it may just be sort of the work of China, you know, the Nigerians themselves, like basically wanting to lump the Americans in with the French and sort of as if, like, you know, it's all the West, right? The West are the imperialists, the neocolonialists. I mean, it's all absurd, but this is the ideology. And they're looking for excuses, they're looking for justification. They also want to understand why the situation in Niger is so terribly bad, notwithstanding Western aid. And this is also something that I hear, like they say, like the Americans say that they're helping us, but look, despite all this American assistance, everything's still really bad in terms of terrorism, which is true, but that completely misunderstands the help that the Americans were actually offering. And the fact that the American help was, we weren't giving them silver bullets, right? It's to sort of magically end the jihadist insurgencies. We were giving them help so that they could do it themselves, because they have to do it themselves. And so blaming us becomes a justification for the fact that they haven't done it themselves and they're not succeeding and things really are very bad.
Are you optimistic at all, given this current circumstances, that the U.S. will be able to maintain some kind of presence in Niger?
No, I'm not. I don't think the U.S. will be able to. I think that the junta is really determined to oust the United States, again, because of these. It's a cheap political calculus, but I'm not optimistic. I mean, it's entirely possible that fast forward 5 years from now, 10 years from now, that a new junta, a new regime is going to discover that, you know, gosh, we're really in trouble here, guys. Hey, America, can you help us? Hey, France, can you help us? So who knows? But certainly in the foreseeable future, I don't think so.
That is Michael Shurkin, Director of Global Programs at 14 North Strategies, a business intelligence firm focused on Africa. He was speaking to me here in Washington. Two people died and almost 2,000 were left homeless when fires engulfed hundreds of shacks in three separate incidents in South Africa's Cape Town during the weekend, according to emergency services on Sunday. They said two of the fires occurred on Saturday evening and one in the early hours of Sunday morning. Cape Town Rescue and Fire spokesperson Jermaine Carrels said in a statement, an adult male and female sustained fatal burn wounds and were declared deceased by the medics at one of the informal settlements. The biggest fire, which occurred early this morning, engulfed over 150 shacks, leaving over 1,000 people displaced in the Mufuleni settlement, some 19 miles southeast of Cape Town. The cause of the fire is under investigation. Shack fires are common in South Africa and are a perennial threat to the impoverished residents of the sprawling settlements near major cities throughout the country. The 800-year Kingdom of Buganda is considered the largest of the traditional kingdoms in present-day East Africa. Its queen, Her Royal Highness Sylvia Naginda Luswata, is not only a custodian of tradition, but also a bridge between the past and the present, connecting the historical legacy of Buganda with the contemporary challenges faced by its people. Queen Naginda, who was in the U.S. recently to launch her new autobiography, The Neba Drika, Life, Passion, Duty, tells VOA's Jackson Mvunganye that she wants her legacy to be that of a champion for cultural preservation, women's empowerment, and community development.
Share with us your role as the Queen of Buganda and, and the responsibilities that come with that role.
Right. As the Neba Drika, I am the wife of the Kabaka of Buganda, or the King of Buganda. His Majesty Renard Mwenda Mtebi, he's the 36th king of Buganda. And in addition to being the wife, I established a foundation in 2000. It's the Neba Drika Development Foundation. The purpose of that organization, the mission is to leverage culture, use culture to improve the lives of children, women, and youth in Uganda, just improve the socioeconomic well-being of children, women, and youth in Uganda. And our areas of focus are health, education, and community development.
Mm. What can you tell us about the Kingdom of Buganda?
The Kingdom of Buganda has been around for over 800 years, and it is built on 52 clans with the Kabaka as the head of the clans, and all of us, the Buganda, are represented through our clans by our clan leaders. You know, below the Kabaka, you have the royal, the chief of the royal clans, and then you have the head of the clans, and you know the prime minister, the katikiro, the local chiefs, and so on and so forth.
Mm.
So it is that top-down structure. It's very inclusive. We do not have a class system. So everybody's represented, and all the Buganda are, you know, subscribed to the Kabakaship.
Mm.
Yes.
You say it's very inclusive. That means women also have roles of leadership. Is that what it is? Is that what you mean? In terms of inclusivity?
In terms of inclusivity, yes. Mm. Women have always had played main roles in within the kingdom. They've always been a pillar within for strength, for support, for stability within the kingdom as mothers in the home and also in the workplace. They still do. They've always been, and they still do.
Absolutely.
Play that role. Yes.
So how do you balance preserving traditions, your cultural traditions, with the evolving dynamics of this modern-day world?
Mm-hmm. The Neba Drika Development Foundation, we have programs, for example, that we've created, and one of them is called the Chisakate cha Neba Drika. It is mentorship, training, and skills development program for children, and at the moment we cater to children between the ages of 6 and 18 within this program. And one of the main ideas really is to instill them with good culture practices and values, we noticed that, now this program has been around for 17 years, but prior to that we had a lot of different initiatives in education and health and community development, and we felt that there was a decline in morals in our society, so we started this particular program. So one of the things really is to instill good cultural values and practices, as well as to encourage spiritual development, which we think is very important to give that moral compass, and also to encourage, to expose children to different skills, the arts, the development in agriculture skills, and we have different activities actually that do take place. And the whole point is that trying to get the children when they're still young at that age, so that to prepare them for the years ahead.
That is Her Royal Highness Sylvia Naginda Luswata. She is Queen of Buganda, which is located throughout a large part of Uganda. She was speaking with my colleague Jackson Mvunganye here at our studios in Washington. This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Carol Van Dam in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sports with Samson Omali. But first, two female entrepreneurs in Mozambique have started businesses that help fight climate change and reduce pollution. Amarilis Goulet has this story from the capital, Maputo. Michelle Joseph narrates.
Vanya Lazaro likes to add a new plant to her garden whenever possible. Over the past 6 months, she has been testing a new fertilizer on her flower and vegetable beds at her home in Maputo, Mozambique. She says that thanks to the product called Ntoko Organic, her plants are healthier. Lazaro says they use Ntoko organic products in the garden because they are biodegradable and free of chemicals, ensuring her household will consume healthier food. After a few unsuccessful projects, Mozambican entrepreneur Marcia Dima Jones founded Ntoko Organic. She says it was during a business competition that she realized that she could produce fertilizer from organic waste, such as dried leaves, vegetables, and fruit. Ntoko Organic collects its fertilizer-making ingredients from the community itself. Dima Jones says her company distributes buckets to people's homes along with labels indicating the types of materials they can put inside them. The approach ensures the quality of raw materials. Dima Jones isn't the only woman operating a green business in Mozambique. Nearly 5 years ago, Karina Jamal founded Cocoa Boxes, a startup that supplies biodegradable and environmentally friendly packaging and paper bags. Jamal says she wanted to create a solid business while inspiring other women. Jamal says that she always wanted to leave a footprint in the world that would inspire not only women, but also her daughter. She says she hopes someday her daughter will be able to say that her mother fought hard, not only to be a successful entrepreneur, but to do something beautiful for the environment. Jamal and Dima Jones are helping reduce environmental pollution and build a sustainable future for all Mozambicans. They both encourage women to take a chance on something they believe in. Jamal says a lot of people are afraid to take risks, but that living in your comfort zone isn't the best thing in the world either.
Project Green Woman.
Dima Jones says that they train young women so they can create their own green businesses and become agents of change in their localities. Then these women can have financial autonomy. According to the World Bank, only about 25% of all businesses in Mozambique are run by women, a percentage these women say needs to grow. For Amarilis Goulet in Maputo, Mozambique, is Michelle Joseph, VOA News.
As you might have guessed, it is now time for Nightline Africa Sports. And for that, let's join Samson Umale. Hello, Samson.
Good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. The CAF Champions League quarterfinals action got underway this weekend with SAW defending champions Al Hotly managing a hard-fought 1-0 win over Tanzanian giants Simba SC in the first leg of the quarterfinals in front of a roaring 60,000 capacity crowd in Dar es Salaam. Another Tanzanian side was battling for a win as there was nothing to separate Young Africans and Mamelodi Sundowns of South Africa in Dar es Salaam on Saturday evening as the two sides played out to a highly tactical goalless stalemate in their first leg quarterfinal clash of the CAF Champions League. Elsewhere, former champions TP Mazembe and Petro de Luanda battled to a goalless draw in the first leg of their quarterfinal clash in Lubumbashi on Saturday. Ivorian giant ASEC Mimosa walked away the happier side on Saturday evening when they frustrated Osborne Sportive de Tunis to a goalless stalemate in what was the last round of the quarterfinal fixtures for the weekend, played at the Stade Olympique in Tunis. The goalless draw sets up a grand finish to the quarterfinals when the two sides will meet in return fixture in Abidjan next weekend, with both teams going into the clash on clean sheets. Staying with football news, the South African national women football team Bayana's keeper Refuole Jane is among the players headlining the squad announced by coach Destry Ellis on Saturday for the final two-legged round of the 2024 Olympic qualifiers against Nigeria. Bayana will face Nigeria in Abuja on April the 5th and host the return leg at the Loftus Stadium on April the 9th. The winner of the South Africa versus Nigeria match will join Brazil, Japan and Spain in Group C in the Olympic Games in Paris in July and August. Jane, who plies her trade in Serie A Sassuolo in Italy, will play her first match for Bayana since the 2023 Women's FIFA World Cup, where she was injured. In athletics, Kenya's Beatrice Chebet successfully defended her senior women's title at the World Athletics Cross Country Championships on Saturday, becoming the first senior female athlete to win the title back-to-back since Tirunesh Dibaba in 2006. World Cross Country champion Beatrice Chebet led Kenyans to sweep five top positions in a women's 10-kilometer race at the World Cross Country Championships in Belgrade, Serbia. The 24-year-old Chebet conquered an extremely strong field of her Kenyan compatriots when she broke away from Lilian Kasiet Regeruk just 400 meters from the finish line to win in 31 minutes, 05 seconds.
But today I thank God because I managed to defend my title. And again, the course was so good. The weather was good.
In the men's category, Ugandan Jacob Kiplimo retained his senior men's title, joining an illustrious list of athletes to have successfully defended a world cross-country title. And that's it for this week's edition of Nightline Africa Sports.
Thanks a lot, Samson. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll be sure to check in with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports, Nightline Africa Sports. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to sit back, relax, and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent. I don't say something is wrong.
push up, push up, push up. Jama beauty, smile up, smile up, smile up. And when we don't day like this, that be when we day in a lovely soup. Like the Mary Jane, I be your highness. I'm on a roll up with the finest, finest, that only one gonna happy, baby. That be when I day happy, baby.
Make me fall champagne. Push champagne. goes day for me, let's still be red, oh, no rush. Like a gorilla, the way she's stressing me, stressing me, stressing. Baby, climb my jacuzzi, my jacuzzi. I know you gonna leave, gonna leave, gonna leave, gonna leave. Somebody pop for D, somebody pop for D. Baby, finally, 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 finally. For my money, more loving. Baby, we feel kind of lazy. You there for the bed, oh, locking out dreads, oh. Kanzo style with the open one hour siashi. Was on the other home house of a co antiadi. Yeah, where your chimney cranny lantiadi. I'll be banging every day and yeah, fiafi. Just a day for the missionary, what ya say? That be why we move from Accra, go to Santa say. Yeah, ladies come and go, yeah. But you on the throne, yeah. You the queen on the throne, bitches for the throne, yeah. Ladies come and go, yeah. But you on the throne, yeah. You the queen on the throne, yeah. Just for the soul, yeah.
Oh my god.
I'll be the girl, them zaddy. The girl, them zaddy. Can you give me 1 minute attention? I'll go down and swear for you. When my name be what your lips they mention, I'll go be right by you. And it means slow progression. Let me watch how I move. Doubting me never go help out. Baby, I go need your groove. And I know what you're thinking, so I go try a little harder. All these things that I'm doing, only to get you to love my mother. Hey. So you can bring on your girlfriend, so we party harder. And you can tell them I'm your best friend. Never, I just want to.
That was our Sunday music spot. We hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English to Africa service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. We hope you enjoyed the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 1800 hours UTC from the Nightline Africa team, including producer Nicole Peters. We say thanks for joining us. I'm your host, Carol Van Dam in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
So I go try a little harder. All these things I keep doing, only to get you to love my mother. And you can bring all your GS, so we party hard. Or don't make me a BF.